DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress. Today on the show, a sexual health bill divides the Philippines.
It's mind-boggling that we're still fighting for the very basic right to determine our own body and our own fertility.
Why overseas adoptees return to South Korea.
Now, you know, I'm in touch with the rest of my family. My mother has passed away, and so I'm learning even more now. And actually, my adoption story is like crazier than I could ever imagine.
And how young people in Cameroon struggle to find jobs.
I struggled to pick up a job in the public service to no avail. I was not being considered everywhere I drew my application. I struggled for a good 3 years, nothing came up.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. A bill on sexual and reproductive health has divided the Philippines. On the one hand, there are those pushing for a sexual and reproductive health bill, which would improve pre- and postnatal care, introduce mandatory sex education, and make contraceptives more readily available. On the other stands the Catholic Church. The health bill was first introduced some 14 years ago and has been languishing in parliamentary limbo ever since, mainly due to the church's fierce opposition. With President Benigno Aquino's endorsement, the bill has reappeared on the political agenda. But lawmakers remain divided, and time is running out as the campaign for parliamentary elections are kicking off this month. DW's Naomi Conrad met two young MPs who are pushing for the bill at a high personal cost.
I received love letters from bishops, from priests, and students, even elementary students.
Raymond Palatino is smiling, but it's a somewhat forced smile. For the letters the young MP receives express anything but undying love. They're insulting, sometimes even threatening. Raymond, who is in his early 30s, has been supporting the Sexual and Reproductive Health Bill ever since he was elected to Parliament some 3 years ago. The price for his support has been direct pressure from the church. His fellow MP, Emelina Glipe, agrees.
Whenever I attend Catholic Mass, since I am a Catholic, my attention is directly called with respect to the Reproductive Health Bill. Since I go to Mass at my neighborhood parish. So the parish priest knows me, and this has been, I guess, quite embarrassing for me.
She shrugs. The two young MPs can live with the embarrassment, even the pressure, because they are convinced that the majority of Filipinos support the bill, which would improve pre- and postnatal care and access to contraceptives and extend mandatory sex education. Sometimes, when priests repeatedly speak out against the bill, parishioners stand up and leave. Others demonstrably turn their back on the pulpit. Aglipe and Palatino are frustrated that the bill has been languishing in legal limbo for more than 14 years because of the Catholic Church's opposition.
Despite the fact that it's illegal for the Catholic Church, they're totally involved in politics.
Amina Evangelista Svanepoel used to work as a researcher for Human Rights Watch until she set up an NGO which supports some of the poorest women in rural areas.
In the last 14 to 16 years, every time someone has been lobbying hard to get the bill passed, leaders from the Catholic Church will vilify these people in their sermons. They'll send out these pastoral letters to all the churches all over the country. And they do really just demonize anyone who supports the bill. It's mind-boggling that we're still fighting for the very basic right to determine our own body and our own fertility.
Call Bishop Gabriel Reyes, a spokesperson for the Catholic Bishops' Conference, and you are put on hold to choral music. As calm and measured as Reyes, who, with impeccable politeness, thanks the caller for taking an interest in the health bill, and launches into its criticism.
The good things that are there, like caring for the woman.
The good things that are there, like caring for the woman, caring for the baby after it's born, they're already in other laws that just need implementation. And besides, if there is widespread contraception, it also encourages promiscuity, conjugal infidelity, and so on, as is happening in other countries, in Europe and the U.S. And also, as history has proven, it reduces the respect for women, whom we have to love and respect because women just become things or instruments of pleasure.
What about a woman's right to choose?
What we are against is that the government should be...
We're against the government promoting contraceptives, particularly to Catholic people. It's not true that providing contraceptives to people will reduce the number of abortions that take place. That's not been the case in Europe or the U.S., where contraceptives are widely available and there are still many abortions.
Abortion is illegal in the Philippines, as is affirmed in the health bill. Svanepoel again.
The Catholic Church has really muddied the conversation by insisting that the bill allows for abortion, which is a complete and total lie.
The Philippines has the highest rate of teenage pregnancies in Southeast Asia. Maternal mortality rates have gone up in the last couple of years. This, Svanepoel is convinced, is a sign of just how badly young people and women need better sex education and access to services. While contraceptives are legal in the Philippines, they are extremely hard to get hold of in rural areas, Svanepoel says.
A pack of birth control pills usually costs between 30 and 50 pesos, which for the middle and upper class people in the Philippines is not very much.
50 Philippine pesos are roughly equivalent to 1 euro.
But we have families, sometimes 6 or 7 people, on less than 5,000 pesos a month. So it's way too expensive for them. Often they're forced to make a decision between, do I buy 1 month's supply of oral contraceptive pills, or do I buy 1 kilo of rice for my family? Of course they're always going to choose rice for their family.
But chances are that the Philippines' many poor may have to continue choosing rice over contraceptives. Svanepoel is not very hopeful that the bill will be passed this year, despite President Benigno Aquino's endorsement. In October, parties nominate their candidates for the upcoming elections in May, and many may be unwilling to take a stand on the bill. Like Palatino, Svanepoel is afraid that the bill might get sidelined and disappear once again.
The absence of a law would give reason for Congress not to allocate funds for reproductive health services, and RH services will not be integrated in the national medical healthcare system.
Bishop Reyes, meanwhile, is praying that the bill doesn't get passed. For DW, this is Naomi Conrad.
In Cameroon, unemployment rates have come down in recent years, but most people in the country make a living in the informal sector, which means their jobs are often precarious and not very secure. Many can only get part-time occupations, or they get odd jobs despite having some formal education. That's particularly frustrating for young people, as Nalat Kilian Chimtom discovered when trying to find out how Cameroonians are trying to make a living.
Theodore Mi, a 35-year-old graduate from the University of Yaoundé, had a lot of ambitions when he started college.
My dream was to become an engineer. So when I got to university, I kept in all my efforts and worked hard, given the fact that my parents were merely surviving from what they were doing. My father was a palm wine tapper and my mother a farmer. So I worked hard. I had my university degree in engineering in flying colors with good grades. And I furthered my education and had my master's degree also in flying colors. Having had these degrees, came to this capital city, Yaoundé, to pursue my dream in the public service.
Many Cameroonians believe a fulfilling job can only be found in the civil service.
I struggled to pick up a job in the public service to no avail. I was not being considered everywhere I drew my application. I struggled for a good 3 years, nothing came up.
In 2011, however, Theodore thought he had his chance when government launched a mass recruitment of 25,000 young certificate holders, ranging from ordinary level holders to university graduates, into the country's civil service. But that turned out to be a huge disappointment.
I was ready for anything, given the fact that I had tried in the previous years to get the type of job that I wanted for myself, but it never worked. So when they launched the exams, I then deposited my application file in catering. Luckily, I was considered. I knew that, thank God, I will have a regular income. But I had a shock of my life that for over 8 months that I was taken in the catering services in one of the government ministries, I never saw a franc.
Disappointed with the job, Theodore had to look elsewhere for survival. Today, he clanks away at metal in a mechanics workshop.
I had to go do mechanics. I was a mechanic in one of the garages here in Yaoundé. So it tells you the type of country that we are living in. Me, a trained engineer with a requirement, with a grit, that I can be earning a salary of over 1.5 million. Yeah, in my mechanic job, earning less than 30,000 francs per month. It is terrible.
These frustrations are shared by thousands of university graduates in Cameroon. 28-year-old Kenneth Winyoy now resorts to teaching secondary school students at home to survive.
I'm a holder of a bachelor's degree in philosophy. I enrolled for the master's program, but due to certain conditions, I could not finish. There is nothing concrete I can do now, apart from tutoring some second-year students in philosophy and French. That's how I pay most of my bills.
A recent survey carried out by the National Institute of Statistics has returned disturbing figures. According to the Director General of the Institute, Joseph Tedu, unemployment in Cameroon stands at 5.5%, while it's dropped dramatically from the 9.3% recorded in 2006. The improvement is little reason for celebration. According to the survey, 96% of Cameroonians simply find refuge in the informal sector, and 76% of those who work are actually underemployed. In other words, they are employed in jobs far below their qualifications, stresses Tedu.
The unemployment level has dropped, but we must underline the fact that the drop is due to the dynamism of the informal sector. That means many jobs have been created, but the jobs are precarious. They're mostly jobs created by youths, but such jobs can disappear at any time.
The difficulties in getting jobs in Cameroon have been linked to an educational system that churns out job seekers and not job makers. The executive secretary of the Cameroon Students and Youths Forum for Development, Eugene Galim, says there is need to change all that.
The educational system should be vocational, should be professionalized in such a way that young people are not only interested in public service, but young people could create jobs for themselves. Young people could take up agriculture as a profession where it will make them independent and be able to employ others.
President Paul Biya, in power for over 30 years now, has been frequently criticized for failing to come up with appropriate policy to create jobs. Now the president is banking on some major development projects such as dam construction, mineral exploitation and the construction of roads to create jobs. But most of those jobs will cease to exist once the projects come to an end. This is Ngala Kilian Chimtom for DW Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to World in Progress, DW's Globalization and Development Show. You can also download this program as podcast or listen to individual pieces from the show online. For more information on globalization topics and the podcast, check out our webpage at dw.de/globalization. Moving on to South Korea for our next story. The country is confronting a dark part of its modern history. Before Samsung or Hyundai emerged as global brands, the nation's top export was said to be its babies. That's because during the past six decades, at least 150,000 Korean children have been adopted overseas. What was never expected, though, was that someday these children would come back as adults. Some have resettled in the land of their birth and are leading a campaign to end international adoptions. Jason Strother has been to meet one returned adoptee who says it's her mission to help Korean mothers keep their babies.
It's recess time at this orphanage in Seoul. About 40 kids live here. Their futures are uncertain. Some will find homes here in Korea and others will stay here until they're adults. After South Korea was left in ruins following its war with the North in the 1950s, orphans were sent to families in the United States or Europe. Throughout the decades, many Western families thought they were giving these Korean babies a better life. Now some of these adoptees, in a pursuit to learn more about their own histories, have come back.
My name is Jane Jung Trinka. I am an internationally adopted Korean. I was born in 1972, and I was adopted with my sister to northern Minnesota at that time, and I came back to live in Korea in 2004.
Trinka says she always had questions about her adoption. Some of the stories her American parents told her didn't make sense. In 1995, she visited Korea and tracked down her birth mother after all those years. Trinka says it was then she found out that her adoption was a total lie and that her biological mother had been trying to find her.
So she went to the orphanage and she just cried until they told her where I was, and then she started to send letters. But of course, my American parents were told that I was the child of a single mother and that I was an unwanted child. And then when my birth mother made contact with my American parents, they really didn't welcome that because the agency had lied to them.
Trinka says in reality, her mother was in fact married, though to an abusive husband. She never wanted to give her children up, but a woman working for an adoption agency took them away from her. As Trinka met other returned adoptees who, like her, were able to find their birth mothers, she heard similar stories again and again. Their mothers, who were often unmarried, were told by doctors and relatives that they were unfit to be parents. And Trinka says many single women are still being told to give up their babies, even today.
They're not being sent overseas or separated from their mothers because the mothers are, like, abusive or they're strung out on drugs or something like that. It's because they're single, and Korea is a very patriarchal society. And what are you doing having a child without being married?
These women do not get a lot of support, either from family or the government. So Trinka and other adult adoptees are doing something about it. This past May, unwed Korean moms were honored in the second annual Single Mother's Day. These are women who, despite the social and economic pressure, decided to keep their babies, even if it meant living in a shelter. That's where this woman, who asked not to be named, once had to stay with her 7-year-old son. She explains that living with her parents was not an option.
It's very difficult in South Korea for an unwed mother to live with her parents. There's a tremendous prejudice towards single mothers, and it's an embarrassment to the family. My parents would feel ashamed to have us living with them.
Jane Jong Trinka thinks South Korea should be able to take care of these women. It's a rich nation now. But she says politicians, mostly male ones, would rather financially support orphanages that cater to overseas adoption agencies.
I really don't think it's necessary at all for them to continue the international adoption program, because they have actually the resources here to take care of the kids. But because Korea is so prejudiced against the women who are having children out of wedlock, instead they are prioritizing their money in a way that favors orphanages over being cared for by your own mom.
Trinka has authored 3 books on international adoption and also heads the activist group Truth and Reconciliation for the Adopted Community of Korea, or TRAC. She's organized protests against overseas adoption, too. At this demonstration along a busy street in Seoul, some adult adoptees held banners with slogans like these.
Real choices for Korean women and children.
Korean babies not for export.
End overseas adoption.
The campaign to end international adoption has met with some success. Ashamed about its history, the South Korean government has recently limited the number of orphans who can be sent abroad. Since 2007, there's also been a push to encourage more Korean families to adopt. But some advocates say the new quota on international adoption ultimately hurts orphans here. Molly Holt is chairwoman of Holt Children's Services, an orphanage and international adoption agency that began in the 1950s. She says hundreds of children in her orphanage alone will never find families here in Korea.
And children that can't find homes here are going to have to grow up in orphanages, because Korean people want to adopt beautiful girls. And so boys, disabled people, what's going to happen? They're going to grow up in orphanages.
Holt says South Korea's history of adoption is sad and will remain unresolved as long as children go without families. For Jane Jong Trinka, digging into her own past has come at a cost. She no longer has a relationship with her adoptive American parents. But learning the truth about her adoption makes it a price worth paying. Trinka says she has a new life now and a purpose, one that her birth mother might have always wanted for her.
I think she really tried to communicate with me the reason why she couldn't raise me at the time. And now, you know, I'm in touch with the rest of my family. My mother has passed away, and so I'm learning even more now. And actually, my adoption story is like crazier than I could have ever imagined.
Jane Young Trinka ending that report by Jason Strother in Seoul. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas traveled to New York last week. He is applying for non-membership status for Palestinians in the United Nations. Last year, an application for full UN membership of the Palestinian people was not successful. Palestinians would like their country to be upgraded to a sovereign country. But while the issue of Palestine status is on people's minds back in Gaza and the West Bank, most Palestinians have other worries to cope with in everyday life, as Tanya Kremer found out in Ramallah. Pavel Schrey has the report.
In Ramallah, in the West Bank, traffic is backed up again on the main square of Al-Manara. But taxi driver Karim Rumani takes it easy. Rumani, whom everyone here calls Kimo, has other worries. The father of six says that everything has become so expensive. That's one reason why he joined a protest of bus and taxi drivers 2 weeks ago. They blocked off streets in several Palestinian cities to protest another price hike in gas prices. The protests worked and prices were reduced, but the resentment remains.
There will be more protests soon. The situation has become unbearable. The prices are increasing all the time. We Palestinians are just tired of that. Our government should be there for us. They are calling themselves the government of the Palestinian people, after all.
At the moment, the Palestinian Authority does not have much choice but to cut spending. The government coffers are empty. The deficit is high, and the Palestinian territories are dependent on international donors. High prices, unpaid wages, and austerity measures are responsible for the growing unease among Palestinians. And there is little comfort in the fact that the World Bank, in its newest report, clearly states that the Israeli occupation and trade restrictions are hindering sustainable economic development. In the bakery Al Arabi, the owner, Mohammed, hears all about the concerns and hardships of her customers. She is also trying to cope with increasing prices. Since early in the morning, the family bakery has been a beehive of activity. Actually, they should be raising the price of bread because the price for flour and rent has gone up. But the government, for the time being, has frozen the price of bread to prevent more protests.
It's not easy for me. Everything has become so expensive. Then the customers ask, why is your bread so expensive? Because we raised the prices for 2 or 3 days. But everyone said, that's far too expensive. Now we take the old price.
The economic crisis in the West Bank is not the only problem weighing on people's minds. There is also the sense that nothing else is moving forward either. Neither the long overdue presidential and parliamentary election, nor the reconciliation between the two political factions, Fatah and Hamas. The proposal from President Abbas to seek some form of membership at the United Nations again this year has hardly led to renewed outbursts of enthusiasm.
They always talk a lot, but we never see any changes. Let's wait and see.
Some of the customers at the bakery say the occupation is smothering the Palestinian economy. They add that even without full membership, being a recognized member would change the situation somewhat. The euphoria from last September's effort to win full UN membership has dissipated. Even last year's ceremonious dedication of a new street, United Nations Square, right next to the official residence of the Palestinian president, seems to have lost its symbolism. Instead of the flags of all UN member states, now only the yellow banners of Fatah can be seen fluttering in the breeze. A year ago, President Abbas returned home triumphant from New York after submitting an official application for membership in the world body, despite international pressure against the idea. The proposal was never voted on in the UN Security Council, and the application died a diplomatic death. Now the Palestinians have come up with a new, slimmed-down version of that proposal. Instead of full membership, they are now seeking the status of a non-member state. this status could be granted by a simple majority of votes in the UN General Assembly. It is not clear, however, when such a vote could take place. In Ramallah, Xavier Abouid is tirelessly promoting the Abbas UN proposal. He is the spokesman for the PLO negotiating team, but he is also aware of the public scepticism and urges patience.
People, they just lost trust. Now what we are trying to do, we are trying to bring hope back. We are trying to tell our people that the dreams to have a Palestinian state, a free, independent state on the 67 border is still possible. And that's why we are going to the United Nations. And hopefully, once our people see that there is a result coming out of it, hope will come back.
In the West Bank, however, hope has pretty much been stretched too thin. Many young people are not particularly enthused. Ziad Shouabi, for example, who is sitting in a trendy cafe with a cappuccino and his laptop, is pessimistic.
If you ask me, as a young person, then I say that nothing will come out of it, which would be useful to Palestinians. We saw what happened last year. Expectations were high, and then nothing came, so the frustration on the street was big. I think we won't get much support for the UN this time either.
Cafe owner Huda Al-Jak hears a lot of what is being talked about in Ramallah these days. During the protests, her coffee shop was well frequented.
So a whole bunch of conflicting messages about the economy, okay? So prices going up, not enough jobs, uncertainty and unemployment, and 1 minute they open up the borders and we can go buy products, and in one moment they close the borders, and so really uncertain, and of course all the politics. Politics have always been uncertain, but there's a lot of uncertainty.
The taxi driver Kimo knows all about this uncertainty. What counts for him is what he sees. From the Palestinian viewpoint, the Israelis are creating facts on the ground, which increasingly are making a Palestinian state impossible.
For us, there is no stability. We're in Ramallah here. Over there is the Bet El settlement. We are surrounded by Jewish settlements. Between Ramallah and Nablus, there are more than 20 Jewish settlements, so I don't know where we're going to set up a state, unless the necessary prerequisites for a Palestinian state are met.
Kimo says his horizon only goes as far as the next Israeli checkpoint. One can only hope, he says, that the world at the United Nations takes notice of the Palestinians and their problems again. We feel a little forgotten here, he adds.
And this report by Tanja Kremer was voiced by Pavel Schrey. And it wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. For more stories on development and globalization, go to dw.de/globalization. World in Progress will be back next week at the same time, when my colleague Jesse Wingard will present the show. And one of our topics will be how favela dwellers in Brazil are becoming homeowners. For today, on behalf of the Bonn studio team, Eliane Giaducci and Christoph Grove, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for listening and goodbye.